welcome to the Real Estate Matters podcast. I'm Stuart Norton with the Alabama Center for Real Estate here at the University of Alabama. Joined as always by my co-host, James Benedetto. James, say hey.
Oh, good morning, Stuart. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thanks. Looking forward to this episode. We have a great guest joining us today. We have Richard Henry, principal at Rightspace Commercial here in Tuscaloosa. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad we were able to get this scheduled. So, just to start off, tell us a little bit about what you do with Rightspace Commercial, a pretty new company, from my understanding.
That's right. So, like you said, I'm located here in Tuscaloosa, and we're primarily on the investment side, mostly focused on office and warehouse. We operate in Tuscaloosa, Birmingham, and Mobile. Tuscaloosa and Mobile are our primary markets. So the bulk of what we do is we buy value add properties that need some attention. I kind of equate it to like the house flipping shows. We come in and fix the properties up and then either lease them or sell them. We also have begun recently doing some tenant rep work to mostly to drive the occupancy in our properties, but also offer to those tenants that if we don't have the exact property in our portfolio, that we will go find it for them.
Gotcha.
Brokerage side is predominantly in Tuscaloosa.
Okay. The focus on value add properties, generally speaking, when y'all are acquiring a new property, will it be vacant or, under lease?
Anything? We'll do both. We do a fair amount of vacant. And we also do properties that are leased and maybe they need to be re-tenanted after a pretty good rehab to the property, or maybe we just need to renegotiate the current leases up to market rates.
Right. Gotcha. Well, it's interesting that the pivot, towards doing small office and warehouse, on the investment side, a little bit of brokerage. Sounds like a, a pretty good pivot from what you did, for the last 10 years or so. I thought it'd be interesting just to kind of hear about, just the transition, how you built Druid City Properties and then sold it. How long ago was that?
Yeah, so we sold Druid City Properties, the residential management portion of that, right at a year ago.
Okay.
I started out of college flipping houses, and then we got into low income Section 8 properties. Really, in the financial crisis, we, banks weren't lending money, so we had to buy the houses we could afford to buy in cash. So we were buying $10,000 and $20,000 houses, and really worked up from there. We sold the lower income houses, bought nicer ones. We got in the management business the third party management business around 2016, 2017. And then, at the same time, we were selling the low income houses, buying better ones. Eventually, as the prices increased, we sold those and bought apartments. And then really at the beginning of COVID, with all the apartment prices going crazy, we sold the apartments. And that's when we were pivoting our investments. And then, around that same time, a company called Pure Property Management, which is a private equity backed roll up of management companies, came calling, and we decided to sell to them. Like I said, that was about 12 months ago. So they just bought our third party residential management company. So we kept our maintenance and construction.
Gotcha.
Business.
So, yeah. How many properties were y'all managing at that point?
Just under 400 is what we sold.
Wow. Okay. So Richard, just from hearing a little bit about how you kind of built up Druid City Properties, you really jumped in right at the right time. I know it was a tough start, but as you've seen in Tuscaloosa, things have just expanded by leaps and bounds. Can you talk a little bit about just what, being in the apartment game here in Tuscaloosa and just kind of how crazy it is at times, because it seems like a new apartment complex is building every single year, and it seems like you're just trying to keep up with the Joneses in that business.
That's right. I mean, a lot of our history is based on timing. Really a huge jumping off point for us was originally the tornado on the housing side, because all that insurance money was flooding into the market. And so, you know, a homeowner may be getting 120% of what they paid for the house from insurance. And then we would come in and give them, you know, maybe another 30% for the house that was damaged. And so we were able to buy cheap property because the seller was actually making way more than they ever thought they could because insurance. But so that was a real game changer. And that really affected the apartment market too, because it took a lot of inventory off the market from the tornado. So all the occupancies, you know, everybody went to 100% occupancy that day in the apartment business. The purpose-built student market really went crazy in Tuscaloosa. You know, and then a lot of outside capital just poured into this market, and the numbers got so crazy that even the, you know, we'll never sell local investors. I mean, you put a number big enough in front of people and then they ended up selling. So it's not near as much of a local game as it used to be. I mean, there's still a good many local operators, but a lot of them did, you know, sell certain assets. They maybe didn't sell everything, but they
sure
sold some when the numbers got too crazy.
Where were some of those out-of-state dollars coming from? Just some of the big areas?
You know, I didn't deal with a lot of them, but I remember seeing New Jersey. We dealt with some Colorado people. I mean, I think there's a few sovereign wealth funds. There's international money. You know, then you get into the build for rent business that we've seen some. It's more prevalent in Birmingham, but there was a company that I know we managed for a little bit that was out of Israel.
Wow.
That were, I mean, that you would deal with individual investors on houses. So, I mean, to be in Alabama, we saw a lot of outside capital the last 10 years really pour in to the Tuscaloosa market.
To follow up on that, Richard, you talked a lot about how, you know, again, the capital's coming from maybe outside state lines. I know a few years ago, the mayor tried to pass some type of referendum or some type of law to kind of try to tamp down how much apartment, you know, how many apartments were being built and kind of like put some regulations on it, a little bit trying to put Jack back in the box, and if you will. Do you foresee, like, if you were to cast it kind of 5 years in the future, do you still see Tuscaloosa having this issue of having just so many apartments coming up, or is it just, you know, meeting demand at this point?
Yeah, so even though Tuscaloosa is not that big, it's a tale of a couple of different markets. What was really happening is we were, the first wave was purpose-built student housing. So think 3, 4, 5 bedrooms is really the issue around that, not the ones and twos, but that you were getting these big unit sizes that weren't really catered to anything but students, and they built them off campus, like a way away from campus, because they could get cheap land. Well, those are the first ones that the occupancy starts dropping, and then they start, you know, having more management related issues. So they put a moratorium on it away from campus, which drove a lot of that development into the core of campus. Tuscaloosa, it's called the Box. It's kind of 15th Street, downtown, the river, and McFarland. So that's when we really saw prices on campus skyrocket, is because they were building there. And there were some incentives to build there. Well, that kind of got out of hand. So they put a citywide moratorium on it till they could retool the ordinances. And they've done that. They've really created a definition for student-oriented on campus. They also put some density limits, you know, units per acre. They lowered that. So it has reduced the demand or the ability to build these mega student complexes, which has worked there. One market, though, that we have lacked development is in the market rate non-student. We really haven't had much construction in that in the last 10 or 15 years. So the non-student market is still pretty strong. The on-campus market is strong. the non-student market is strong. The only real soft market is the purpose-built student market away from campus. You know, and I'm talking not walking or biking distance.
Right.
You definitely have to get in a car and drive a ways away. Market has struggled.
Right. But and go ahead.
Failed complexes. The crazy thing is like there have been some examples where complexes have essentially failed and somebody else came in right behind them and bought them for big money. So you really haven't seen the failure.
That's a very interesting point. Yeah. I know some of the, large, student built type projects you mentioned. And I think, in some of these, it's, non-students might occupy about a third of the building, at the end of the day.
That's right.
Yeah. And so, just to kind of wrap up student housing, I feel like, you hear people say, is student, kind of a common question. I mean, I remember it from years ago when I first moved to town. I mean, that was 2012, but is student housing getting overbuilt? And it doesn't seem to be the case at this point, especially in the box, as you mentioned.
Yeah. The on campus is still strong. The supply faucet's really been turned off on that. From a density standpoint, and then now construction costs. But so I think that on campus is still strong. It's just that off campus.
Right. Yeah. And I'm surprised, the way rents, because obviously rents have been growing, over the last, since COVID essentially. And obviously even before that, but I was talking to someone recently who owns some student housing, in the box, talking about 900 to 950 per bedroom, and these are pretty nice units, but does that number sound right?
I mean, you're definitely seeing that. I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily the rule, but
right.
But you're seeing that. I mean, and you get into one bedrooms, I mean, you may be going 12, 14, 1500. I mean, on a one bedroom.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, on the nicer walkable stuff, you're definitely seeing that. Some of it depends on amenities, but
sure.
It's a long way from, the 300 days 20 years ago.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. My brother had a house on 15th Street. This would have been like 2006 and 7, but he had it for 2 years and it was 500. It was a 2-bedroom place. And so it was 500 per bedroom, 1,000 for the house, right in the middle of 13th Street.
Oh, I take that deal all day.
And I believe it's been, torn down and rebuilt. But interestingly enough, you might know this guy, Richard, but my brother's landlord, his name was Rex Spruill. And that was my dad's landlord when he was here back in the late 60s. So
that's right. And his sons are still in the business in Tuscaloosa. I mean, he still is, I believe, but his sons are definitely still on 13th Street and all over. But yeah, I think they've torn down most all of those old houses and, you take 2 bedrooms and you can put 15 on it.
Right.
Economics work pretty well.
Yeah, I've seen those. Yeah, it seems like that's kind of or not necessarily a recent trend, maybe starting 10 years ago, but, one building that might have anywhere from 8, sometimes even 12 bedrooms, and leased by the bedroom instead of, for the entire house, I guess it's just kind of easier to manage that way. But yeah, those, and they look super nice from the curb, never been in them, but those, larger units, probably 8 bedrooms on average, but yeah, that's been a good development, good idea, whoever, put that model together. I'm sure it's not just one person though.
Yeah, there was really it was before my time, but there was right before it, there was really a negotiation. The historic districts wanted the students out of the historic districts. And so, the zoning was changed where you could only have 2 unrelated people living in a property in the historic district, but they allowed what was called the U district kind of on that 13th Street to where you could have 4 and 5 bedroom units. And
right.
You could build a triplex of 4 and 5 bedrooms. And that's where you really got that density. So it worked to pull all the college kids out of the historic districts and really bolster those back up for what they were designed for. And it moved the students. So it was kind of a give and take that worked really well. Again, that was right before my time. Mm-hmm. So it was probably in, early 2000s.
Right. Yeah. I remember a good friend of mine in Birmingham. He had a house. He started out as a pharmaceutical sales rep. and had a real nice house on Capel Wood, you know, had the historical marker out front. And and in his early 20s, he lived there while he was working and leased two bedrooms to some friends from high school that were studying law at the time. And then eventually he, you know, he had some, when he moved on, it was leased to students. I think it was a three bedroom. But yeah, but it fell under that historic thing. And I think he got a letter in the mail, you know, and so he ended up selling it just to kind of put his dollars somewhere else. But I'm sure it turned out to be a great investment for him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So so kind of while we're on, so I appreciate that that student housing update. That was a lot of really good information there. And we're going to get back to the small office and warehouse. But before we do, the short-term rental market, you know, just with football season here, can you just tell us what's new in the short-term rental market here in Tuscaloosa? I mean, any new regulations or just anything you can provide about short-term rentals? I always find those pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's gotten to be real popular on the, I guess, owner landlord side. A lot of people have wanted to get into it. The regulations have been kind of ebbing and flowing in Tuscaloosa. Really in the city limits, outside the city limits, you don't have as much regulation on it, but you've got to get approval through the Zoning Board of Adjustments now, and they've got night caps. So like you can only rent in different areas only 30 nights a year, 45 nights a year. So they're kind of just trying to discourage a short-term rental to be like a full-time short-term rental.
That makes sense. Yeah.
You just buy it as a pure investment. It's more, the ordinance is really more catered to, you know, if you live there and you're going to leave, or, you know, or just a partial use of it. So that's been kind of a change with it from once they started writing the regulations. But there's still a lot of interest in it. I think people that get into that business, they underestimate the operating expense. You know, so a long-term rental, you're putting the landscaping and the cleaning and the utilities and the furniture and the TVs and internet and all that, you're putting that on the tenant. Well, now you've got that in your operating expense. So yeah, your rents are higher by the night or whatever, but your operating and carrying cost is a lot higher. So I think people are not necessarily seeing the profit margin that they expected. So we're seeing some turnover in the sales market on the short-term rentals.
That's interesting. Yeah.
If you just have a game day and you're just happy to get a little extra income, you're not necessarily trying to be profitable. I think people are happy with it, but to do it as a pure profit center inside the city limits is pretty hard right now.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, the last time we did a podcast, it was several years ago. And I remember you talking about a few short-term rentals that you did. Are you still in, and one was a lake property, I believe. Are you still in that as well?
Yeah. So we had two on the lake and we've got some down at the beach and stuff, but, we just recently sold one of them on the lake. Kind of two things happened. One, you know, the market, we did okay with it. It was a marginal investment for us. I mean, it was profitable, but it wasn't just a phenomenal investment. And the prices went up so high on the lake that when you're looking at that amount of equity we had, it was kind of a better deal to sell that and reposition it. So we just sold one on the lake. We still have one. And we're renting it out for football season. We're not renting it out in the summers right now.
Gotcha.
So we're kind of back to that partial rental, like some of the other people are.
Yeah.
But football season, I'm glad not to go to the lake for football season for what some of those rates are.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. And yeah, just prices on the lake, you know, I'm, you know, and it's like, it's fitting in with many other, you know, recreational, like Lake Martin. I mean, prices down there, I mean, median sales prices, you know, because we see that monthly. I mean, they've been over $1 million for about a year now, just the median sales price of anything selling in a month. But what would you estimate appreciation on the lake has been? I mean, just like post-COVID, I know that's kind of a tough question, but any estimate there?
I mean, just off the top of my head, I would say 30-40%. I mean, in a 5-year span. You know, if you took like 2018 to, you know, late 22, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think you saw some properties double, but I mean, I think you definitely saw 30, 40, I mean, maybe even 50% price increases.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. That's kind of what I was kind of thinking about that range as well. And just one final thing about lake properties, since I've just talked to people who have done this, but, what all goes in, like, say you're building new construction on the lake, there's no existing dock. I hear that permitting process, cause you got to work with the city, right? You know, cause the city is basically, you know, it's water supply for the city of Tuscaloosa.
So we're a little different than other areas. The city of Tuscaloosa owns the lake versus it being a power company lake. And so the acquisition line is measured from normal lake elevation, full pool. You go up 8 feet vertically and then you come in horizontally. So it's different really on every lot because of the elevation, like how steep the bank is. So if you got a real steep bank, your elevation line, you know, your acquisition line is close to the water. We had this house on the lake that the lot couldn't have been much flatter. And so, I mean, it was probably 70 yards almost to the acquisition line because it was so flat. But so you're building your dock on the city's property. So you've got to get their permission and their standards. And it's not terrible. I mean, they're pretty reasonable to work with. They've got pretty good design standards. But the electrical, because of some accidents and incidents out there, the electrical, they're very particular about, rightfully so. And they're doing more frequent inspections. So if you're doing a short-term rental, you've got to also have your dock inspected. I think every year you got to get a home inspection. You got to do different things like that. So if you're doing short-term rental, it's even more strict.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I just knew there was quite a process, you know, to just getting that permitted and built.
So Richard, like we discussed earlier, you know, you kind of got in on the apartment housing side during a really tough crisis, and now you're getting over to the commercial instance, and it seems to be another tough economic field out there. Can you talk a little bit about the adjustment of moving from the residential to commercial and just how much of a challenge it's been for you? Or has this been something you've really enjoyed taking on another part of the industry?
Yeah, I mean, I've enjoyed it. I always like a challenge. And it really just got from the pricing, the difference in what we could buy at and what we could rent it for. That when housing started heating up, we couldn't afford to keep buying property for what the rents were. Mm-hmm. And we kind of hit an economy of scale, too. It wasn't worth our time as much to keep doing a house here and a house there. So that's really what drove us to the apartment side. You know, instead of buying one unit at a time, we can buy 10 or 20 or 40 or whatever we could find at that time. But what really happened on the apartment side is the cap rate got so low. I mean, people were just trying to buy everything they could find. Mm-hmm. Where, I mean, we were selling effectively at, like, they weren't looking at it this way, but effectively at a 3% cap rate of what we were operating at on some of these apartments. These other investors just wanted apartments so bad in the South that they came calling, well, for 3.5 cap, I will sell you some apartments and then I will go buy something else. And we really got into office in the middle of COVID. Especially in Mobile, we were able to go down there and buy office space at $20 a square foot. I mean, we bought one complex, I think it was about 40,000 feet in Mobile. It was like a 10 cap at 50% occupancy. Wow. We were paying like $20-something a square foot on the office space. I mean, that's what we were paying to purchase it. We're getting $12 for rent.
That's a no-brainer.
You go from 50% occupancy to 75% occupancy, and I mean, we love it. That deal is a lot of smaller suites, which has really been our area where we've really been successful. I'm talking anywhere from 400 to 1,500 square foot on that property. per suite. So you think about the person that needs two offices or three or four, not real big, a lot of mom and pop. I mean, some regional credit, but that's been our wheelhouse. And then on the warehouse side, now warehouse has been really hot. So we're kind of in two different sides of it there, a colder market and a hot market. The warehouse side, we've done some larger stuff, you know, in the 20s and 30s per space. You know, we bought a 110,000 square foot complex that had, you know, 25,000 square foot buildings in it. But we really love that office warehouse market too, where you're getting a 1,500 to 3,000 or 4,000 square foot space. A lot of those tenants are not represented by other brokers. They're coming direct to us. And I tell people on the office space side, we really run it like an apartment complex. We go in there and get the offices fixed up. We go in with LED lighting, new paint, LVP floors. It's move-in ready, just like you would an apartment. And then you're not really negotiating tenant improvements. You're picking which floor plan you want. Mm-hmm. And so we're going direct to these people because their lease may only be, you know, $1,200 a month. It's just on a 3-year deal, that commission's really not enough of incentive for a broker to really work with them.
For sure.
We're glad to work with other brokers. We have no problem with it, but we really just don't get as many calls from brokers. We're getting calls directly from the small business owner. And so that's a big focus for us, is we'll work direct with them. We, you know, try to figure out what their needs are and put them in the right space so their business can thrive.
Gotcha. Yeah. What parts of Mobile are some of these small office complexes located?
We have one on Azalea, which is kind of south of airport. You know, it'd be a couple miles south of like USA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are B- type properties. Mm-hmm. We've got an office building over on Bel Air, right across from the Bel Air Mall. We bought an old DHR building. We're trying to get some lease deals done on that one. It's been slower. We've got a few people working right now. We may, if we don't get something in the next couple of months, we're probably going to convert it to self-storage.
Okay. Yeah. It seems like that's still, I feel like I see a new self-storage pop up.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we've got some office warehouse down there, kind of industrial areas on Halls Mill. And so we're kind of all over. We've got one property on airport, but we just did a warehouse deal on government. Surprisingly, not far from where they just announced that new Dave and Buster's. So,
okay.
There you go.
Yeah.
Mobile's been a good market for us. We've been able to find some undervalued properties down there that needed some updating, and we've been happy in that market.
Awesome. Well, yeah. Well, that's great to hear. On the warehouse side, what kind of value are you also doing value add on the warehouse side as well?
Yeah, most everything is. We have in-house construction, so
okay. Yeah, that makes it official.
We really self-perform most everything except for painting. We outsource painting, but I mean, we come in and do. We're a licensed mechanical contractor. We'll come in, do our own light, electrical, light plumbing, a lot of demo, and then a lot of flooring, paint. The warehouse, man, it's amazing. I mean, if you take an old metal building and you get the decorator to pick some nice colors, you know, good looking paint costs the same as drab, boring paint, so we try to make them a little nicer, make them look good. It's amazing, man, what paint does to these old metal buildings. It really makes them look like a new penny, and we're able to raise the rates, and we'll re-tenant them. We'll get, you know, kind of problem tenants out of there that maybe take up too much of the exterior space, and get people to, follow a set of common rules in the common areas, and just have them well-maintained, well-presentable, and we've done well with that.
That's great to hear.
Yeah, Richard, last question from me. You were talking about the office space, and you were kind of running it like an apartment, you know, just kind of coming in and putting in all the changes to the amenities beforehand, so then you can just kind of talk about a lease price and whatever works. Do you see that, just being something that's going to be successful and maybe non- larger metro areas, like, you know, your big cities like New York or Chicago, do you feel like that that's going to be better for office markets, you know, maybe in the Southeast or, you know, maybe in the Midwest?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it will. I mean, again, our market is going to be in that small suite B to B minus kind of property. So, I mean, I think, you know, the class A large tenant is still going to want to customize their space. I mean, that's still going to exist. But what we're doing, you know, our tenant's a little less sophisticated on the real estate side. And so they're not planning 6, 9, 12, even 24 months out. I mean, they're like, hey, we need something next month. And so, hey, you can move in. It's ready to go. The also, we're seeing that people just don't have the vision to come into an old, dated office building. And you sell them on this vision of what it can be.
That's a good point.
And these tenant improvement packages, man. I mean, you get an architect and a designer and everybody just dreaming about what this space could be. I mean, the cost can be so high that the deal doesn't make sense for anybody. And so that's why we just try to have it nice, you know, reasonably nice. And then they can decide if that's what they want. And then, I mean, they just come in, start paying rent, and they move in next week. So we try to have everything move in. It's not as full service as these flex office providers of Regus or what have you.
Right.
Co-working. We're not doing any furniture or anything like that. But I think people want as much of a fixed known quantity as possible. You know, they know how long it's going to take them to move in. They know what it's going to cost. We know what it's going to cost because we do it every day. And so it just takes a lot of the unknown out, which has been really hard on both sides of the deal, the tenant and the owner side, especially in the office market.
Yeah, that's a good point, that turnkey approach that y'all take. You know, just having the unit ready to go, move in ready, essentially. They can tell that some recent work has been done. But yeah, I would imagine, you know, because, you know, typical commercial property, especially office, you know, unimproved could sit vacant for quite some time, you know, before the right tenant comes around, you know, negotiating the tenant improvements and all that. So yeah, I mean, that's a pretty innovative approach that you guys are taking. And it sounds like there's demand for it. You know, you have these, you know, the mom and pops, you know, just looking for something ready to go and then boom, y'all have it right there. That's good market insight there.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's worked in that smaller suite space. I think in the larger ones, it's probably more risky to go spend a lot of money
for sure.
A 10,000 square foot space that somebody may walk in and want it all ripped out. But for us, we almost built it in like the marketing budget, if you would. You know, it's like, let's get it ready. Let's make it showable so we can move it faster. We have yet to really rip a lot of it out, but we may end up making some modifications. But we feel like we have a little bit faster leasing process, so we feel like it saves us money on vacancy. So,
right,
we're okay with the risk of doing the work up front. And again, we control the cost a lot better with in-house construction.
Absolutely. And so, kind of sticking to office, but you know, not necessarily your area, but just you know, say the Class A office market in Tuscaloosa. I would imagine, you know, because most folks I know, you know, I mean, they're back in office, you know, have been so for quite some time. But how's Class A office in Tuscaloosa doing?
So Tuscaloosa is a very different office market really than almost anywhere. We've had such little supply for so long. We really don't have much, if any, vacancy. I mean, I can only think of one or two even suites available in the market in the Class A. There's just been a very little supply. So it's real strong. We don't have big users, so there's not a ton of them. So it's hard to justify building a new building because I don't know that we have as much demand, but our market is really balanced. There's a really all asset classes in Tuscaloosa. Right now we're seeing pretty low vacancy. I mean, there's some pockets of retail that are seeing some vacancy, but outside of that, I mean, the warehouse market is very tight. Office market's tight. Really, A, B, and C office market's tight in Tuscaloosa.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, you don't really see, you know, a lot of the office space, you know, it's just kind of smaller, you know, just fitting with Tuscaloosa being a smaller city. But on the multifamily side, like the non-student housing, but just, you know, kind of speaking generally about Tuscaloosa, I mean, it seems like most communities, you know, just have a shortage of housing units, you know. I feel like Tuscaloosa kind of fits in that category. But just what about, you know, just the apartment market in general, you know, say class A or B apartments in Tuscaloosa, non-student housing, but how are those markets doing?
I think they're tight. I haven't
sure
talked recently, but last time I did with some of the non-student landlords in town, I mean, they were all, I mean, very happy. I might not say 100%, but they were, you know, in the high 90s, so they were happy. Again, we just really haven't had much supply in the non-student market. So,
yeah,
you know, you think the, you know, north of the river, there hadn't been a lot of supply. You know, downtown, very little supply because it could be student or non-student, but I think that most of those operators are pretty full. I think really the only softness is in that purpose-built student away from campus.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And then just to kind of talk, you know, just housing for a bit, but I'm just continually surprised to see, you know, kind of the northern part of the city, you know, like say Highgrove, for example. I think that's planned for what, 700 or 800 houses if they make it through all the phases. Does that sound right?
I think so. It's at least north of 600.
Yeah.
It's a good number.
Yeah. But every time, you know, I got a few friends there, we live close by, but I feel like every time I drive through there, you know, you see another house built, you know, it appears to be sold, you know, and occupied pretty quick. But it just makes me think, I'm like, where are all these people coming from, you know, and how are they affording this?
I think everybody asked that when they built a couple hundred or 400 or 500 in the towns. Nobody knew where they were coming from. And it
exactly
kept going, and it's coming through Highgrove. And, you know, I talked to the builders, and it's funny. You'll say, how's it going? Oh, slow. Well, you got any houses finished? No, I don't have any houses finished. So, you know, they'll tell you it's slow, but yet there's not much inventory still.
Right. Now, I would assume.
Awkwardly enough, I have a house across the street in Waterfall that's for sale, and it has been slow on it. But
gotcha.
I think they're still, I think Highgrove's still selling well. You know, I think that you're seeing a cash buyer in that price range, or maybe they have more cash, so the interest rate isn't quite as hard on them.
Mm-hmm.
As compared to like the lower and middle, where it's, you know, 95% loan, and they're right on that bubble of being able to afford it with the interest rate. So I think that market has moved. It's definitely slower than it was, but it's still moving.
Gotcha. Well, Richard, this has been very informative, you know, having you on the show today. I just wanted to say, you know, just, you know, congratulations, you know, on the just building and, you know, building up Druid City Properties over the years, you know, and selling that about a year ago. But just congrats on all your success. That's awesome that you have this, you know, Right Space Commercial up and running with a pretty cool niche that y'all have kind of figured out, you know, that small office and warehouse. But just always good to catch up, and really, you know, great insights as always. Any final thoughts as we kind of wrap it up here?
No, I mean, I appreciate you having me on, and if I can ever do anything to help you or anybody else here in Tuscaloosa with anything, let me know. We're here to help however we can, whether it's exactly what we do or not. We're always glad to advise people or tell them what we're seeing. So,
gotcha.
We're like most real estate people. We like sitting around talking shop and learning from other people or telling them what we know. We enjoy it. So
for sure,
help however we can.
One last thing though, we have been talking a touch of football at the end of each episode.
Oh, that's true.
So what's your outlook for Auburn for the rest of the year?
Man, you know, I went to Auburn and I honestly don't pay attention enough to it to know. I think they'll bounce around like normal. You never know. They'll lose one they shouldn't. They'll win two that they shouldn't. And it'll be a roller coaster, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. I think they made a good hire with their coach, you know.
I mean, I think give them a year or two and they'll be right in there for sure.
Yeah, I know one thing's for sure is at least recently, you know, the Crimson Tide have struggled on the plains for whatever reason. But hopefully we can, hopefully the Tide can notch a win down there in Auburn this year, get it back on track.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, hey, Richard, we appreciate having you as always. Let's stay in touch.
Sounds good. Thank y'all.
You're welcome.
This has been the Real Estate Matters podcast produced by the Alabama Center for Real Estate. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, Spotify, Podbean, or just ask Alexa to play the Real Estate Matters podcast.